Right now at Honda, find your kind of value with a low finance rate offer on selected Civic hatch and sedan models. There's never been a better time to get into a Civic. So talk to your local dealer and let's help you into a Honda today. T's and C's apply. Ends August 31st. See website for details.
You're listening to Errol Parker and Clancy Overall, editors of the Batuta Advocate on Desert Rock FM.
Hello and welcome back, listeners. If you're listening live, we're coming out of the Koala Studios here at Desert Rock FM. And if you're one of the many listening outside of the Channel Country, thanks for tuning into this podcast. Coming up, we'll be having a chat with a famous cricketer and an equally as famous television presenter, Mike Whitney.
Yes, all that's coming up after the local news. Thank you for tuning in wherever you are in the world. I'm Clancy Overall.
And I'm Errol Parker. And if I'm here in the studio or in the newsroom, it means I don't have to be at home with the father of my newly born grandson.
Ah, the father of your bastard grandchild, eh?
Yep.
For anyone who didn't tune in last week, Errol is playing host to his daughter, his newly born grandchild, and his future son-in-law. And I thought you said you wanted him to stay on the scene, Errol.
Yeah, I do, but I don't mean literally in my own home, though. You know, a couple of nights ago, Clancy, I walked out into the kitchen because I couldn't sleep. I'd been thrashing around in bed like a carp on a riverbank for a few hours, and I poke out into the kitchen and I see this dude standing there in the kitchen in the nude with the fridge door open, helping himself to my chocolate. I nearly jobbed him.
Well, it's enough to make any man see, considering, you know, everything you're doing for him and you know, his reputation around town prior to shacking up with Stella. Yeah.
Yeah, and to make things worse, mate, I've had to eat my own words, and I bought them a koala mattress. It came up from the coast in the van in its little fucking box. We've just had to cut it open this morning. It's all rolled out and it's ready to go. Cost me a bit, but yeah, look, I just thought I'd do the right thing.
Well, you know, for mattresses, they don't cost much, but yes, they definitely do cost much in the sense of buying them for what you described as a sack of shit. You actually said you weren't going to buy them a mattress.
Well, it is a lot cheaper than going to, say, Harvey Norman, because old Jerry Harvey, if he sees you walk into his shop, he'll hang you upside down by your ankles and he'll shake every last coin out of your pocket, that bastard will.
Yeah, well, he's in for a shock when Amazon really takes hold in Australia, isn't he?
He is. But I went and bought the mattress anyway. You know, after Pippa, my darling wife, she put the hard word on me and I couldn't say no, really. Couldn't have my daughter sleeping out there in the hallway on a single mattress, you know, and him in my living room on the futon.
Well, at least he's a bit out of sight there, I guess.
I guess so. And I guess if anyone else is in a pretty similar predicament to me, they can get themselves a koala mattress using the discount code, which I used, and that's STRUTH200 to get $200 off your mattress or sofa.
Yes, and in local news, we'll keep it quick this week because it is a hell of an interview with Mr. Whitney.
Yeah, we've got Mike here just on the other side of the glass waving in at us.
He looks like he's ready to talk. He's got that energy, 110%, you know. He's got that Steve Irwin thing going on behind the glass. So I can only imagine we're in for a long haul here. In other news around town, police and other services are pleading with kids to stop jumping into the local quarry.
Yes, kids, please, please don't give in to temptation and go for a swim, even though it is in the middle of July. The old quarry has filled up with water again after the rain we had earlier this week, and kids from all over town have taken the opportunity to go for a bit of a swim.
But as is probably understandable, the water in the quarry is laced with elements of toxic waste and severely detrimental to anyone's health, let alone the health of young adults and children.
Yeah, that's right. I love a good swimming hole as much as the next Batutan, but kids, please heed the warnings from us, the emergency services, the CSIRO and the Department of Primary Industries.
Councillor Keith Carton has also been pretty firm on this issue as well. I know kids, you know, at that age are daredevils and, you know, quite excitable. But please, practice safety.
Well, on that daredevil note, here he is. We have the king of dares, Mr. Who Dares Wins, Michael Whitney in the studio, so we better get to it.
Yes, here we are with Michael Whitney. Thank you for joining us today, Michael, a former cricketing sensation. 12 tests, I believe, under two different Australian captains for Australia. A iconic character, you know, he became a media icon after his work in advertising as a face for Tuis. And Of course, his job for Channel 7. The last 27 years, he's been hosting adventure and getaway shows for the 7 Network. And, of course, Who Dares Wins. If you were born after 1950, there's a chance that you spent some time in your life watching this man on the TV screen, whether he was playing cricket or whether he was hosting TV shows. Mike Whitney, thanks for joining us.
That's a huge start to the show, boy.
I mean, it's
lovely to be here.
Let's be honest. Everyone has watched you on TV at some points religiously. Everyone in Australia.
I've never really thought about it like that. But, yeah, look, I've been at Channel 7 now for 24 years and shot a lot of shows for them. Sydney Weekend has been a stable for that whole amount. But, yeah, Who Dares and Gladiator. Remember I was a ref on Gladiators? Gladiator! Yeah. Oh, you're ready. That was hilarious. But, yeah, a lot of time on telly, I suppose, with the cricket. So, yeah, it's been pretty loud. The radio has been up pretty loud for nearly 40 years now. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been crazy.
The nation first got to meet you way back when you were playing cricket there in the late 70s, early 80s there for Australia. It was an interesting time back then because we weren't winning that much. I suppose kind of like we are now. We're in a bit of a period where we're
except this last 5-day series in England.
Well, yeah, that's yeah. But then off the back of that, we did have probably one of the biggest scandals in Australian cricket for a number of years.
You're not going there straight away, boys, are you? No, I'm cool. I'll talk about it. No dramas.
I'd like to start there. just to address the elephant in the room.
It's a big elephant.
If Alan Border, if he came up to you as a fairly young and inexperienced player, and he had a bit of a plan, he said, "All right, Mike," he said, "I've got to get this ball moving. You know, we're over here in England. We're getting done. And I need you to get this ball moving. Here's a little bit of sandpaper. Don't get caught.
Bit of Vaseline on the boots, yeah.
A little bit of lip balm." So if a captain asked you to tamper a ball, would you?
Oh, that is a seriously tough question. I'll take you back to Trevor Chappell and Greg Chappell.
Yeah.
I mean, Greg asked his younger brother to bowl underarm. That's gone into infamy. If Trevor had have said no, he probably would have never, ever, ever played for Australia again. So that's the situation you're in if the skipper asked you to do that. The issue, I haven't answered the question. That's a very, very tough question, bro. Because the skipper, in my eyes, always has been, always is and always will be, man, he's the boss.
Yeah.
He's it's not the team manager, it's not all the selectors and that. He's the man and he runs the team. And what he says goes. Mm.
So it's a bit of an unspoken code that you always have to follow your captain in his battles.
Absolutely. I mean I played under 2 Australian captains, Kim Hughes in my first couple of tests.
Yep.
And then Alan Border for the rest of my career. I only played 12 tests, so I played 10 tests under Alan. Mate, if Alan had said to me or Kim, "Man, I need you to stand on one leg down at the boundary and pull your shirt off," you do it.
Yeah.
You just do it. I mean, those first couple of the first 2 tests I played, I was Johnny on the spot in England in 1981 and just happy to be rooming with Dennis Lilly and, you know, playing with Kim Hughes and Rod Marsh and Graham Yallop and Graham Wood. I mean, all those guys I'd grown up watching play. And it was a bit different when I got back into the team a few years later where you're a bit more of a mature player. But I could never imagine an Australian captain going up to anybody and saying, "I want you to tamper with the ball." And look, let me start this conversation by saying this. Ball tampering's been going on since the late
1800s. Yeah. Yeah, I'd imagine that to be
bit like prostitution.
Well, yeah, you know, like over the past sort of few years, you've had lots of instances of ball tampering. You know, you've had...
There's 24 incidents of ball tampering in the last 10 years, including Faf du Plessis, Michael Atherton, I think Virat Kohli, I think Waqar Yunus got done.
Who tried to bite the ball in Pakistan?
Yes. Shahid Afridi bit the ball on the ground.
Yeah. Like an apple.
Like it was an apple.
Like an apple.
Trying to get some teeth marks in there to upset the airflow, obviously, but...
Which brings me on to my next point.
Which method's the best?
Well, hypothetically, what would be the best?
Have you seen down at Petersham? What's the best kind of method they use down in the park?
Look, I never actually thought about ball tampering for a long, long time until you hear someone got nailed, until this incident came up. And then I thought, did I actively ball tamper when I played, or did I know anybody that did that for New South Wales or Australia? My answer's no. But I don't know whether, you know, if you're walking back and cleaning the grass out of the seam of the ball, and if you lift the seam at that time, that's ball tampering. Look, I'll give you a great example of what a grey area this is.
Yeah.
My sister, who's 2 years older than me, has always followed my cricket career. She never played cricket, but her and my mum were avid watchers and got to know the game. So when all this hit the fan, she rings me up and she goes, you can polish the ball, can't you? I go, yeah. She went, but I've just read the rules. And it says if you purposely change the condition of the ball, that's ball tampering. I went, that's correct. She said, so you can polish and change the condition, but you can't scratch and change the condition. And I went, yeah.
Yeah.
So where do you actually draw the line in going saliva, sweat? I mean, Imran Khan came and played a season for us in 1984-5.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
He was the guy that taught us how to bowl the ball reverse swing.
Yep.
Now, he used to walk back to his mark with the ball under his armpit or in the small of his back, just pumping water, as much sweat as he could, to get this ball going reverse. And it worked. Now, we were lucky that we played at the SCG, and pretty much for my whole career, it was a turning wicket. So the ball really got damaged early, and by 20 overs, the shine had gone off one side and it was hacked up. So we didn't have to. But look, I remember stories of subcontinent teams, and I'm going to name them because they know, the Pakistanis taking out bottle tops onto the ground in the 70s.
Yep.
Someone had a huge thumbnail into the ball, and you could not beat them in Pakistan because our guys would be bowling gun barrel straight and their guys, after about 25 overs, were swinging it a meter either way. And our guys could not work out how this was happening until Imran came out and said, oh, this is a great place to bowl reverse swing at the SCG. The ball gets hacked up naturally and you've just got to shine and polish this other side and it'll go. And it did.
Mm.
And we were unbeatable there. I mean, other sides used to come and look at the wicket and go, oh, because they knew they were ineffective trying to bowl seam up and normal swing.
So it's like it's love, you know. It's like death and taxes and ball tampering, you reckon?
Yeah.
Prostitution, death, taxes, and ball tampering. The oldest professions there are.
Well, in saying that, how it was so prevalent, do you think the punishment has been appropriate?
No.
No.
No way. No, nobody else, in my understanding, in the history of the game, has been kicked out of the game for 12 months. I mean, all those other guys.
Yeah, I suppose the last one was Warnie, wasn't it?
Yeah, but he wasn't ball tampering, was
no,
he?
No, but that was for...
taking drugs.
Well, no,
whatever he was taking.
It was
that his mum gave him to lose some weight.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. For the team picture.
Yeah, I love Shane. I really love Shane. I was Shane's first roomie on his first overseas tour to Sri Lanka. And Alan Border said to me, because I was the second oldest by age on tour, not the second, you look after him. And that's when he had the mullet and all that. It was a lot of fun. We reminisce about it every time we see each other. But there has been no fine anywhere. But look, this is what changed. When they came back, Cricket Australia found them for bringing the game into disrepute.
Yeah.
This is not ball tampering. This opens up a whole
that's a media
door of sanctions.
Yeah.
And
The media carried it to a point where these guys were then accountable for how the media had
become obsessed with it. Man, my sister, in the same conversation, said, when these three guys get back, are they going to lynch them from the Harbour Bridge? That's how I said, it sounds like it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about rubbing. And for the time that Cameron Bancroft did that, It would have made no difference.
That, that was the next question I was going
to
ask.
No.
That was going to ask. Is it, you know, you talk about Khan coming out here and showing you how to get real dirty. You'd see the Pakistanis taking nails onto the pitch. But in that circumstance, is that more of a confidence pseudoscience that he's doing there? Is that like superstition?
Yeah. Is a tiny piece of yellow 2B sandpaper really going to make that much difference to a...
Probably after about an hour.
Yeah.
But for the over or two, look, I think, and I was watching that night. I stayed up and watched that a lot of that series because I knew it was going to be tough. I mean, they're a very tough race of people, the South Africans, mate. They will call you everything and want to beat you up on the ground. They're the first dudes in the dressing room to say, come round my house for a barbie and have a beer. I mean, they're the most generous people off the field. On the field, man, look at their rugby side. Man, would you want to run into Oostie van Oostenhausen, who's this 120 kilo Afrikaner madman running at you? So I knew it was going to be a vicious series, and it was. And the crowd over there, do you remember Merv Hughes chasing a dude up the race with a bat about three tours ago?
Yeah.
Apparently, that guy just called him a fucking fat prick. For three tests in a following, Merv, you're a fucking fat prick. And eventually wore Merv down. And only that, And a few other words, only that it had a wire cover. Merv was into the cover and the guy was on the other side going, you're still a fat prick, Merv. Merv would have killed that guy. Now, is that fair that people are allowed to do that? I don't know, but look, it was vicious on and off the field. Yeah. By the time it got to that third test match, I think David in particular, and look, I've pretty much been made aware that even as they were out after the game at night time, there were calls from the public on the street, you know, Sonny's whacked your missus and all of this. So I think... if there had been a bazooka in the dressing room during that third test, one of them was going to try and put that down the leg of their trousers and blow people up.
Yeah.
The thing that I thought straight away about it was, look, when I played my first test in 1981, I think there were six cameras at the ground, two at each end and two at square leg, and one at each end was a spare.
Yep.
There's now like 30 to 35 cameras at the ground that can zoom in.
There's one for every player in there.
Man.
Yeah.
So how they thought that putting your hand in your pocket, because that's not normal.
With bright yellow sand.
It's not normal behaviour.
No.
Yeah.
And this is what happened. My understanding was Farnie de Villiers was in the Afrikaner box next to the English commentary box. Farnie was a great bowler. You understand body language out on the ground. I mean, I watch the game all the time and I can see a side withering and then two guys trying to pump, whatever it may be. But he kept seeing Cameron put his hand in his pocket. Now, you do that in England when it's cold, but you don't do it in South Africa or Australia. You never have your hands in your pockets.
Yeah,
and in and out, and then zoomed in, saw it. They lied about it. Then the other thing I was super shocked about, and I've got to apologise to Cricket Australia, I suppose, because when the press conference happened 12 minutes after they came off the ground, I went, who's let them do that? I've since found out that Stephen wanted to do that press conference and just try and finish it then and there. And watching that press conference, it seemed like they didn't actually get the enormity of what had gone on.
Mm.
And this was serious shit. And they'd been caught on TV and it had been on the big screen and the umpires had asked them. And Cameron Bancroft actually pulled out a sunglasses case, a soft one that you clean your sunnies on. And I'm going, where's the sandpaper or whatever? And then he undoes his trousers and drops it down the front, full screen. I mean, it was just...
Yeah, they didn't realise they were in memes right across the country by that point.
You know? So then the press conference, which, as I said, I don't think they really understood the enormity of that. And then, well, the shit hits the fan. I mean, the three of those get barred. Boof steps down. This is...
And James too's gone.
James is gone. The first thought I had, but could you imagine sitting the first day of the last test match when all this has happened in the third test and your captain and your vice captain and your opening batsman's gone and you've still got to play a test match?
Mm.
Now, because I played a couple of test matches, I'm telling you now, it is no place for the faint-hearted. And every morning in that dressing room, particularly the first morning, you better be on, not 99.9, 100 you better be on. Otherwise, you're going to be a weak link that creates a dent in the team. They can expose that.
Yep.
So I just felt for these boys sitting in the dressing room on the first day of the last test, and it was never going to be a contest. No. I mean, they, you know, they could never cancel it, but they should have and just sent us home. It was just a terrible, terrible state of affairs.
Broken, man.
Well, get to the one-year ban. I mean, nobody else has ever been banned for that long. Players have been fined $20,000 or banned for a game or something like that.
So. That goes back to the captaincy thing you said earlier too, doesn't it? It's like Bancroft wasn't you know, dragged across the nails in the same way Smith and Warner were, because everyone kind of knew it came from the top, and Bancroft was a young fella that was taking orders.
Yeah.
And I think, look, if what I've heard is correct, and I can't be, you know, 100% about this, but from what I've heard, Stephen went over and said, "What are you doing?" And apparently said, "Oh, you don't want to know." And that was the moment where if that had been Alan Border, he would have gone,
"Okay, you're concussed.
Throw the fucking shit in the garbage bin now, and or you don't want to ever play again."
Yeah.
I mean, but...
Did he want to go home?
But
you want to go home?
At that moment,
come here.
And I might be wrong about this, but from what I've heard, Stephen then walked away.
Yep.
Now, I want to talk about Stephen for a sec. If you told me that Steve Smith got caught smoking a durry behind the toilet at school, I'd go, nah. No way. He's just not that sort of kid. He is a lovely, gorgeous human being who's just got this outrageous talent to bat, catch, field. You know, let's not forget he got into the side originally as a leg spinner, batting six or seven.
Yeah.
But he is just a lovely kid, has not got a nasty bone. And he's very competitive, hates losing, play tiddlywinks. He wants to smash you up against the wall. But outside that competitive edge, just a lovely, gorgeous human being. If you touched him on the shoulder, he'd give it that one.
No.
But if you touch Dave Warner on the shoulder, he'll go, hey.
Yeah.
And I know that because we grew up in the same suburb. I'm a Matraville boy.
Yeah, right.
And Maddow's a tough place to grow up. Mm-hmm. It was tough when I was growing up there in the late 50s, 60s and 70s. David comes from Housing Commission and he's fought for absolutely – he comes from – and this is – I know his parents, they are fantastic – and his brother, gorgeous, gorgeous people. But they come from nothing, man. Yeah. They were just a struggling Housing Commission, really hard-working Aussie family. So David's – been a
bit more of a pit bull,
mate, a 100% volume loud all the time. And I know this because I've just stepped down as the patron of the Coastal Cricket Club, where I've been patron for 20 years. This is one of the junior clubs in the Southeastern Juniors Association. And Usman Khawaja and David both played for that club as kids. So as the patron, I saw them play as kids and then I saw them develop. Usman came to us at Randwick Petersham as a 16-year-old, and David went to Eastern Suburbs and played there. Then he came to our club 5-6 years ago. So I've watched them both develop, which was crazy because Usman is the coolest, most laid-back dude you have ever met in your life. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just so cool, Uzi. And David, he'll take you on.
Yeah, he's on the front foot.
He's on the front foot. He's exceptionally competitive. You know, in those early days, he just didn't want to hit the ball for six. He wanted to turn the ball inside out that he hit it that hard.
Yeah.
Well, you see Smithy and Usman are stroke players. So
Did you see the writing on the wall for those kids?
When you saw them?
Yeah.
They were extraordinary. Really amazing, and knew that if they applied themselves and kept going the way they were through junior cricket, that they certainly had an opportunity to have a professional cricket career. And we haven't seen the best of Usman yet.
Yeah.
I know how well Usman can play, and we have not seen anywhere near the best of him. A couple of glimpses here and there. David, we have.
Yeah.
And just to go back to him and Stephen, over the last 5 or 6 seasons, they've scored 40%. Smith and Warner, 40% of our runs. So to remove, that's your captain and your vice-captain as well, who are steering the ship round, and to remove those two guys out of that whole system, there's more ramifications to how that whole system works than just saying, oh, there's two players that aren't going to play for a year. Look, I think both of them are going to walk away from this moment and really have a look inwardly and outwardly as the captain and vice-captain, the state of the game in Australia. Where are we actually at? What did we actually do and what are the ramifications of that? And what can we do to help the game now move forward? I mean, look, David's already said to me, because I told you he plays for our club and we needed to know whether he was going to play. After Canada, he comes back. He joins us for pre-season training at Snape Park at Maroubra. He promised me he'd be there. Yeah. He said, if some of your first graders think they've trained hard, he just laughed. So he's looking to lead the way. He's happy to come out and do some of those community hours in the Southeastern Junior Cricket Association, which is four or five junior clubs, one of those which he played for, Coastal. So that's fantastic news. And he's going to open the batting for us in the first five or six games of the year. Why he's only committed to that many, I don't know, and I didn't want to ask him. But all I know is this. At the Randwick Peterson Cricket Club, for the first six rounds of the great competition, I have got one of the best players the world has seen since the war in all levels, hanging out with my young charges at the Nets, open to any question, and playing with my first grade, who has got some really good young players coming through the mix as well, that can only benefit by asking him what and David's really free and open with all that sort of stuff. I'd actually got asked a couple of times, were we going to let him play? And my answer quickly was, well, you know, we have a duty to our players as well at Randwick Petersham, and he is a Randwick Petersham player. But if I said as the president of the committee, no, he's not playing, he's cheated and all this, 19 other clubs would be ringing him tomorrow saying, come and play for us. So why would I do that? Why would I let that go? And we have a duty of care to our players.
And you want to win.
And we want to win, absolutely. I want him to get double century, 150, 100, 300, whatever. Get out there, absolutely.
Now, another question I want to ask is the brand of, and we can talk about Warner here, the brand of the cricket is very different nowadays. And when you started, they had the gold chains and you had the curly hair and they had the mullets. You know, you'd see Dennis Lilly and Tomo at other ends and they were
Dennis
Cowboys.
Dennis bought that cricket bat out. He was the first one to get a cricket bat, you know, cast in gold and wear it around. And it was huge, everybody. Yeah. Well, you thought if you got one of them, you were going to bowl like DK, you know?
Yeah, and they were showing their kind
of... As a fast bowler.
They were showing themselves as well. They were showing their, you know, where they were from and whether they were from Matraville or Bankstown or whatever. They had a bit of flair about them. I mean, it feels like the modern cricket is trying to, you know, mould himself into a Woman's Day-friendly kind of face, get the magazines and live and almost have a career alongside their career. Do you think that's troubling as well? There's a little less character. I mean, obviously, there's a little less characters in the game, but there's also a little less freedom for these blokes.
Society's changed so much. Yeah. You know, look, Greg Matthews and I laugh all the time that if social media had been around when we were playing, Mo and I would have lasted one season in the early days.
Cliffy Lyons said that the other day too.
Because, you know, I think about when I first got in the New South Wales team in 1980, and, I mean, 90% of the people out there didn't even know who you were. They didn't know you played cricket. Your face was, unless you got six for something against Queensland and you got that photo in the paper, no one actually knew. So we could go out, have a beer, have a meal, unless someone was a cricket tragic, they'd come over and say, oh, can you sign this napkin for all this sort of stuff. But times have changed. And I thought when I retired in 1994, you know, I'd pretty constantly been in the team for the last 4 or 5 years and played in the 92 World Cup here, made a couple of tours, West Indian, Sri Lanka. I felt like I was in a bit of a bubble then, but it's nothing compared to what these guys are in now. They earn serious money, like serious dollars. Some of the cricketers around the world are earning $4, 5, 6 million a year just for playing IPL and endorsement, stuff like that. I don't think that they're in as comfortable a position as what we were.
Yeah.
I mean, I could still go down the road when I was in the Australian cricket team.
Tip a couple jars.
Yeah. Widow, good on you, mate. Bloody had a bowl well in that one day or the other day. It wasn't this sneaking up with a camera and, oh, David Warner or, you know, someone's over at the bar and, you know, people sneak photos and it's really weird now. It's much, much weirder. And because they're in this bubble, people think that they're in that bubble.
Yeah.
And I know Steve Smith and Dave Warner have no drama with people going up and go, oh, hey, Smithy, how you going? He'd go, good, thanks, mate. But they sort of, I'm not sure if he'll tell me to fuck off or whatever. And 99% of the time, that's not true. Yeah. I mean, I have people doing that with me. I had a dude last week I mean, I believe this. I'm up in Coles at Maroubra Junction. I live in Maroubra.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh! And I went, oh, shit. What? And I looked at him. I thought something was on the floor or something. He goes, oh, Mike Whitney. I go, yeah, mate, how you going? He goes, what are you doing? I've got fucking toilet paper and stuff in the trolley. I said, I'm shopping. He went, what are you doing here in Maroubra? I went, well, I live here. And this is such a common response.
Yeah.
The guy went, I didn't know you lived in Maroubra. And I go, how the fuck would you know where I live, mate? Like, I don't know where you live, man. Like, how would you know that? And I thought, and then he goes, oh, I thought you'd have someone that would do your shopping for you. I went, mate, I'm a poor ex-cricketer, you know. Yeah. Like,
Channel 7's paying that.
There's all this mentality about that. And I think...
Does any ex-cricketer have someone doing their groceries for them?
Maybe Shane. Maybe Warnie, that's about it. So there is this perception like that where I think 99.9% of the guys are fine. You can approach them all the time. It's changed a lot, a real lot. Mm. I actually feel a little sorry for the boys sometimes because they're just under the pump 24/7. But look, I also say this. You want to earn $5 million a year as a sportsman? You give away a lot of that privacy, man. Yeah. You give it away.
Yeah.
You earn $1 million as a sportsman in this country, you give all of that privacy away. Yeah. People want to see shots of you at a bar or having a restaurant or hanging out with
new missus. Yeah.
Whatever.
So but you had a bit of profile before you even were captain of Baggy Green. You were in Tui's ads. Like, you were still playing state cricket when that happened, weren't you?
I just got back from England in 1981 where I'd been pulled out of obscurity to play two tests. So I played for New South Wales 80-81.
Yeah.
And then decided in the off-season that I wanted to go to England and play league cricket.
Yeah.
And went up into the Northern Leagues in Lancashire and was playing there. Got called by Gloucestershire, who a couple of... Well, Mike Proctor, the great South African fast bowler, and another guy called Brian Brain. Now people go, who's Brian Brain? He took 2,000 first-class wickets as a seamer in England. But they'd both... Yeah, who the fuck is Brian Brain? And they're calling me and they're going, Brian Brain's broken down. Oh, and I've heard of Mike Proctor, but so you check up Brian Brain, just this gorgeous summer. Anyway, they needed a bowler, so I played a few games for Gloucester. On the back of that, Australia was touring, and they watched this one-day game I'd played for Gloucester, and I'd routed Surrey in this 60-over one-day match, which was really weird in those days. So you bowl 12 overs, and I'd taken like 4 for 20 in 12 overs and knocked 3 ex-test players over. So then Lawson and Hogg got injured. And I got this call. You've been added to the squad. So we come back and they approach me and Dirk Wellham, who'd made his test debut in that series as well. I debuted in the 5th test and Dirk debuted in the 6th and got 100 on debut. And for some reason they decided they didn't want to use Dirk. They'd use Steve Rixon again. Yeah. And we made that ad with the West Indies.
How do you feel when you face Big Joel for the final ball and your blood chills? How do you feel when a cover drives, sees a run in sight, you run like hell? How do you feel when you beat the ball, stretch foul on the field? How do you feel? How do you feel?
I feel like a Tui's. I feel like a Tui's. I feel like a Tui's.
That was 1981, and I've got to tell you, boys, constantly, still, it's 2018. Dudes come up to me and go, that fucking Tui's ad, man, that was the best ad that was ever on television. Or how do you feel? Yeah. How do you feel, widow? And I go, man, it was 1991. I mean, it's getting close to 40 years ago. Yeah. But they were such an amazing set of ads.
Yeah.
And they've become iconic, which is crazy.
Do you think that's what put you into your career onto Channel 7 and Who Dares Wins?
Yeah, because you didn't really have much downtime, did you, from the time when you hung up the boots to...
Not much.
Ending up on the small screen.
Yeah, look, this is what that ad did for me. That ad was so all-encompassing for a while that I'd be out with my mates, say at Randy Wicks up at Randwick. The old Randy Wicks.
Les Norton.
Yeah. Les Norton legend. And someone would come up and go, oh, man. Yeah, because I had the big afro and all. Oh, man, you're the actor on that Tui's ad. And I go, oh, fuck, well, I've actually played a couple of test matches. Well, I'm actually a cricketer, mate. Oh, I didn't know that. So it gave me this profile outside of the game as something else, but still involved in cricket, which at the time was just huge. Mm. And I want to tell you all, people go, geez, you must have made a lot of money out of that ad. I got paid $2,000 to shoot the ad, and every year that it was on, I got the $2,000 plus 10%. So in year two, I got $2,200. Yeah. And I played the ad for about 7 years.
Yeah, right.
So for 7 years of being on that ad, I made about
$15,000.
$15,000. But it was the profile that it created. Yeah. Now, you asked me about retiring. I retired February the 10th, I think, 1994. It was 2 weeks before my 35th birthday. And that's a real heavy day, man.
Yeah. Oh,
I just had my 9th knee operation, and the body was really hurting and wearing out. But, you know, it's so much a part of your life, and, you know, the last few years of your career, you're pretty much in your head and your technique, you've got it right, and then the body starts to fail. You talk to everybody, mostly all the fast bowlers go, yeah, the back half of your career is the best.
Yeah.
Because you learn how to train, you learn how what you need to
get
do.
Your head right.
What your responsibilities are, where you fit in the team. You might be leading the attack now for your state, bowling first change or second change in the test side. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But you've got it together, then the back of the, you know, all this stuff starts happening.
Knee back.
So, I cried. I cried a lot. I cried the days coming into that because my then wife and I had decided that I'd written a book called Quick Wit about growing up in Matraville and playing the cricket. And at that book launch, I would announce my retirement. And we launched the book. I had some wonderful friends there, the Ella brothers, who I grew up with and played footy with for 10 years out of LARPA. They came along and told stories about how they were much better cricketers than me when we were kids, and it was true. But I announced my retirement that day, and I'll never forget, I was stunned by the outpouring of emotion immediately as it happened, because the whole New South Wales squad was there.
Yeah, right.
And guys like Wayne Holdsworth, who was opening the bowling then, ran up to the stage and just hugged me and cried on my chest.
Right. Everyone feels it.
Oh, man. You know you've been a part of the scene for a while, and I'd played for 14 seasons at that stage. But I never thought that I would have that sort of impact on individuals. Mm-hmm. And you realise that you do. And these young guys are looking and feeding off every word. You've been around a long time. You played test cricket. You've had all these knee operations. You know how to tough it out. What does it take? All of this. And blokes like Jeff Lawson and myself were always really free with handing the information out. The era before us, not so free.
Yeah, right.
Because it was like, don't let a sucker have an even break. He might take your spot.
Yeah.
Henry and I changed that around to, well, we're going to give you all the information. If you're good enough, happy days, bro. Take my spot.
Yeah.
If you end up better than me and you're going to serve New South Wales, Australia, take my spot. And Cracker Holdsworth was one of those kids. Henry and I spent a lot of time with Cracker. And look, he played a lot of seasons and was very quick and a good bowler for New South Wales. But I'll never forget him, his head on my chest and just these tears running down. And then, of course, that made it a very emotional afternoon. And then what do you do?
Mm.
What do you do after that? I'm nearly 35. I'd done an apprenticeship at Qantas as a ground engineer, which I'd finished and really loved working at Qantas and working on aeroplanes. And I still love aeroplanes. I mean, I still read about aeroplanes now. But I didn't want to go back and grease undercarriages after traveling around the world and playing cricket.
West Indies, Jamaica, and you'd seen all that.
Look, I went on the last long tour Australia ever went on. And I remember being in a hotel here in Sydney, and Bobby Simpson was talking about that West Indian tour. He goes, this is the last long tour, and it will be this tour to the Caribbean, and we're going for 3.5 months. And I heard Mo Matthews up the back go, yeah! Yeah! And it was the last long tour. I mean, tours just don't go for months and months and months now. But what do you do after you finished? I mean, I certainly wasn't anywhere near financially enough to retire. No
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I probably
yeah.
had enough money in the bank to keep me going for a few months.
Yeah, yeah.
So I actually got asked to work for Channel 9
okay.
and do the commentary, and I went home, and a fax arrived at my place, and they said, tick all the dates that you're available to work for the cricket this coming summer. Man, I just ticked them all, sent it back, never heard anything, rang them up, never heard anything. Then I got an opportunity to make a show on the ABC out of the blue called Great Ideas, which was about innovation and invention, the Victor lawnmower and the, you know, all this really funky Australian stuff that
we've done. So at that point you've got a profile now where people were willing to put you on anything. Is that what you're saying? Like, because to going from commentating to hosting an innovation program,
it was really
on the
bizarre.
ABC, yeah.
And I tell you how this guy rang me up on my mobile phone. His name was David Flatman. I mean, I didn't know who this guy was. And he said, "Oh, Michael, David Flatman here." "Oh, yeah, mate, how you going?" He goes, "I produce TV shows for the ABC, and I saw you speak at a function 2 weeks ago.
A corporate gig."
And I'd really started to get this after-dinner speaking stuff together.
Yeah.
I'd worked out some comedic timing, some really funny lines, and listened to a lot of other people. And I was getting pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And on the back of him watching me do a 40-minute spiel at a sporting gig,
mm-hmm.
he asked me to host this show.
Wow.
So he must have thought, oh, he's got enough chops to get out there in front of the crowd, and he was very funny and his timing was good. So I went and I made 13 episodes of this show with the ABC, and it was a really great grounding, I realise that now, in television, because this Pommy guy was working for them, this Adrian Brandt, and he was producing my stuff. And I'd do these pieces to camera and he'd go, "Oh, that was a great fucking rehearsal. That was a good rehearsal, mate." And I'd think, "Geez, I thought that was pretty good." He'd go, "Fucking get it up, mate.
Yeah.
Pick it up." So I realised that this level, which you think's pretty good, is time it comes back on the screen, it drops.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got to
ramp it right up.
Yeah, you've got to ramp it right up. As it happened, he's one of the guys that went to partnerships with another bloke and thought up Who Dares Wins.
Right, yeah. right.
That Adrian Brand and David Mason, two English guys. So he saw something also in me doing great ideas.
And he got you to that level where he could keep you.
So at the end of that year, that show finished. Channel 9 rings me. I go, "I've been calling you guys for 7 months and I've just signed with Channel 7. So this phone on the other end, "How dare could you do that? You ex-cricketer." "See ya." "See you later, boys. I sent you faxes. I did everything I could. I had to go and work for 3 months on the ABC waiting for you to get back to me." I wanted to do the cricket.
Yeah.
I would have been, "Man, I'm sitting in there with Richie and Bill and I would have loved doing that."
Yeah.
But I tried and tried and tried and tried. And the Channel 7 thing was weird. A guy called Chris Chapman was running Channel 7 at Epping and I'd played first grade cricket against him.
He's at ACMA now, isn't he?
That's the guy. He batted number 3 for the University of New South Wales and was very unlucky not to play a Shield game. So I knew Chapper.
Yeah, right.
And he rang me up, "Come out to Epping." He said, I know you've done that great ideas. Yeah. I've watched you. Channel 9. I said, "No, it's..." He said, "Oh, apparently you knocked the job back." I went, "No. I was on to them for 7 months. They never called back." He said, "We'd love you to do sport." I went, "I don't want to do sport. Just played nearly 15 years of cricket, man. I need a break." He said, "Well, we've done 7 episodes of this show called Sydney Weekender. Yeah. And if you want to, you can learn the chops on Sydney Weekender." So that was, I started January 1, 1995. It's now end of June 2018, still doing Weekender.
Do you reckon you'd be one of the longest running blokes in a TV show in this country?
Yeah. I don't know for sure, but the girls are always looking at, has there been any other shows of this genre? And it's infotainment, information entertainment, that have gone, we've made nearly 1,100 episodes, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think there is. I mean, if you look at Play School and shows like that, they've got thousands and thousands
or
of eps up.
On Home and Away.
Home and Away.
Yeah.
All of those shows.
Those guys all took breaks too. The thing is, like, media careers are short at the best of times.
Yeah.
That career you've had on Sydney Weekend is probably longer than many careers outside of media.
Unbelievable. And I didn't really look. We got to 5 years, and then we got to 10.
Yeah.
And probably that first 10 years, I was working really hard to understand what you needed to be a good host of a television show. So I was still challenging myself, you know, can you climb up that tree? So I had a couple of really good producers, Charlie Wood and Alan Dungy, and they'd go, can you get a harness on and climb up that tree and open the show from that tree? Well, I was up there. Or can you open it? We'll put a lipstick camera reversing back the other way. You'll have to wear the backpack. I want you to open the show off a motorbike. We were the first show ever to go HD.
Yep.
In Australia, we were a bit of a test case for Channel 7. We've been the first show to do a lot of things in Australia, but on a very small statewide basis. We're not national. And shows above us, really big national shows, have taken our lead and then put that into...
Well, the Queensland version's the Great Southeast.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if that's been running as consistently as the
Sydney. On and off.
Yeah, yeah.
It sort of comes and goes. Yeah. A lot of... I think there might be a Brisbane weekender now and an Adelaide weekender, but no one has been around consistently for 40, 45 weeks a year, every year for 24 years. And the first year, which is the 25th year ago, they made about 10 eps to put their toe in the water to see how the show was going to go.
So you've been basically anywhere you can go within a three-hour drive of Sydney then, I guess.
Well, it started like that. Yeah. It started like this circle around Sydney, Sydney weekender. So, you know, maybe...
Matraville.
Yeah. Foster Taree, out to the Hunter Valley, to Lithgow, Blue Mountains, you know, down to Nowra, maybe just... So that whole ring. And then very quickly... Airlines like Hazelden Airline, and there was another one too, which have now formed to create Rex.
Yeah, yeah,
right. Regional. There was these two little regional, and all of a sudden we could fly to Bourke, and it just started to open up, and the roads were getting better as well.
Yeah,
yeah.
So all of a sudden we started pushing out. Then it became the whole state, and many times we approached the network and say, like, Lake Eyre is filling up for the second time in 2 years, and in Aboriginal memory. That has never happened. And they'd go, it's in South Australia, you can't go. And we'd already had sponsorship lined up and aeroplanes and all this to go and shoot it as a story for Weekender, but we couldn't do it. The last couple of years, that's changed. We've been to Canada. We've been to a lot of Pacific islands. I actually haven't been to Canada myself, but the crew went over there with another presenter. Did that. We've been to New Zealand.
Right.
We're really starting to step out because shows like The Great Outdoors and stuff like that don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we're the only basically program.
Ernie Dingo's on Mystery Road.
Well, Tourism New South Wales know that we're the only platform that they've got in New South Wales now to promote New South Wales as a tourism place. Yeah. So we're getting a lot of sponsorship. The show's very buoyant. Look, it's all about ratings in TV.
Yeah.
And you've got to pay for yourself and make a dollar for the network.
Yeah.
And I think it's just astounding that Sydney Weekender has done that for 25 years.
Yeah, it's impressive.
I was saying, I got to the 15-year mark, and that was a big thing for me because I'd played cricket for 14 years, and I never thought in my wildest dreams I'd find something to keep me locked in and entertained and purposeful and wanted to turn up. And then I got to the 15th year, and I went, shit, that's nearly 30 years of doing shit that you've really enjoyed, Michael.
Yeah.
Well, now it's... nearly 40 years.
Yeah, yeah.
The 15 years of cricket, and next year at Sydney Weekend will be my 25th year. 40 years of doing something that you've never had a drama getting out of bed to go to work.
Yeah.
Mate, blessed, bro. Yeah, absolutely blessed. Blessed.
But by comparison, I mean, everyone probably in New South Wales and Sydney seen you on the Weekender, but you went national with Who Dares Wins. And also by comparison, that was 3 years, wasn't it? Four years.
Yeah, 95, 96 and 97, we made Who Dares Wins.
Feels like it could have gone for a decade, you know. It was pretty much everywhere.
It could have gone, and I think... I've never asked Adrian Brand or David Mason if this was the case, the two producers of that show. But I think... when HIH, the insurance company, rolled over in the late 90s, the insurance premiums for those shows. Like went up times 10.
Of course.
And I don't think there was any bottom line left in it for them. Yeah. So what they did is they took it overseas and made it, I think they made it in Norway and Sweden. They made it in a few countries around the world and left Australia alone. And when it stopped, oh man, I still get people coming up saying, oh, when are you and Tanya going to make the show again? And Tanya and I have talked about it relentlessly. We'd do it tomorrow. Right. We'd even do you remember this?
He's teasing a comeback.
Yeah, look, it was amazing, and it's regarded now as one of the original reality TV shows.
Yeah.
So let me apologise to everybody listening for the crap that I see now on TV. Some of it's just fucking terrible, isn't it? But we were there at the start, and nobody had ever been out on the street with cameras, you know, daring people to eat sheep's eyeballs for $50.
I think one of my aunties had to get the lobster out of the fish tank up in Queen Street Mall in Brisbane.
Yeah. Well, I'd walk into the office, which was over at Crow's Nest, and they had a chalkboard up on the wall. And I'd just see this list of stuff that they were thinking of, and I'd go, you're fucking joking, aren't you? You've got to be fucking joking.
Drink a jar of mayonnaise.
Yeah, man feeds shark off the barrier reef by hand. So what sort of shark? And so we actually did that. This is hilarious. They made the guy a chainmail metal glove.
Yeah.
So my question was, well, what if the shark bites him up there? He's just going to swallow the glove, take his arm and swallow the glove as well. I mean, but this guy actually fed these white tip, black tip and grey tip reef sharks.
Jesus.
Are like a day and a half right out off the reef. And I was down there and we were all underwater and he actually fed them. It was crazy because they could have just, in those days, I mean, they just would not let you do those things today.
No way, man. I remember seeing those guys jumping from those... You took them to Vanuatu to jump.
I went over there, Vanuatu.
With those vines wrapped around their ankles.
Yeah, man.
That's our next break. Yeah, that was wild shit.
Well, I can kind of understand now that if I was an insurance man and I had a couple of English sort of dudes saying, all right, I'd like to take this tax accountant from North Sydney. I'd like to take him over to Vanuatu and tie some vines around his legs. And it's like, oh, geez.
Jump him off some bamboo scaffolding.
It'll cost you. Amazing
that you brought that up because in the end, that guy said no.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then we all stood there. I stood underneath that building. Now, the thing about that building is it's on a hill, this steep.
Yeah.
So when they jump, and they land, they're actually...
Yeah, they come down. On an ascent, yeah.
But still, when you stand there and you look up, and it's not nailed together. One dude in the tribe, the chief goes, you've got to build the tower. Fuck. If he fucks it up, I mean, serious shit. And it's tied together with these yam vines, which they put around their legs to jump. So if the tower's there, the first jump is only about 5 minutes. It's generally one of the kids.
Yeah.
So he jumps. And the design is that he walks out onto this thing, and when he jumps and those vines pull tight, the little platform that he walks out on breaks and then falls hard up again so the next guy's not impeded by the... Unbelievable. Unbelievable, this thing. But then the last guy, who again is appointed by the chief, you're off the top and you can't say no. I mean, if you say no... This is the man thing. You're hunted out of the tribe. You're the weakest, lowest, filthiest thing. So this dude's up the top, and I'm telling you, it's a long way up with yam vines tied around your legs. And this is what they told me.
You can
only do it when those yam vines are right. If they're too dry, you can't do it. If they're too wet. So there's only this window that they do this, and it is got to be what, mate. We got back to the hut that night, and we actually got on the carver, real carver
that
they made. I thought that was just a myth. Man, the real carver, mate, seriously, we were off chops on this carver. But we just talked about what these guys had done, and the women were there dancing, and it's a huge thing for this island. I've never seen anything before or after like that in my life. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
So you told him he had made the right call?
Absolutely. Wouldn't be doing that, brother.
Was there any other scary moments you had? Any other moments where you're like, whoa, holy shit, we nearly killed a man on TV? Or...
Well, see, if you remember back, the idea was if old mate didn't do it, Tanya and I were up for doing it. And in the end, for some reason, Tanya must have got the shit end of the stick because she did about 20 and I only did about 12 or 14. And she was gutsy, Tanya. But, yeah, look, there was a couple of dramas. A guy broke his shoulder driving through a wall of cardboard boxes stacked with hay that they lit up, and he'd never ridden a bike before. So they trained him for 2 days just riding the bike, and they said to him, look, if you go through this wall of fire and any of the hay gets caught on your visor, because he had the full fire suit on, just turn your head and it'll blow off and you'll be right. So to his credit, wang, 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 boof, through, and he had this big bit of burning cardboard, and what he did was he jumped on the clutch and the front brakes together in panic and just went over and broke his shoulder. So that was one injury. There was minor injuries, but nothing really ever super serious because I've got to tell you, for the time, the safety things around that, man, we were hanging people off cliffs and unheard of shit. I mean, out of helicopters, and the only ever bungee jump out of a helicopter in New South Wales or the ACT was done on Who Dares Win, and it was done in Canberra. And that chick ended up getting on the speaking circuit being a fucking motivational speaker. Unbelievable. But she jumped out of the chopper in Canberra. So there was one-offs never to be done again.
Yeah,
and like I said, I'd see that board with shit written on it, and I'd go, oh, no, you're joking. And as you would expect, as the show went through its motions, what was a big deal at the start of year one was nothing at the start of year two. So it just kept having to amp it up. Maybe it was a good thing
that it finished.
Maybe, where it would have gone.
Getting shot at with bulletproof vests on.
Definitely there's this age group of people that were maybe 6 or 7 up to 20 when that was on.
Yep.
And Tanya tells me as well, constantly going, you gonna dare me?
Yeah.
Or who dares wins? Or why don't you bring the show back? And I asked those people, oh, you watched the show? Best show when I was a kid. But yeah, much loved. And Gladiators at the same time as well.
Yeah,
I was a
referee on Gladiators.
Yeah.
Now, we want to, you've actually, pivotal moments in TV history. We want to just finish now on the Mike Whitney Band.
Yeah.
And I'll say that we wrote an article about the Mike Whitney Band. We're saying that it was, the Batuta Advocate reported that it was a shame and it was actually almost a disgrace that the Mike Whitney Band didn't get
a travesty.
And the Splendor in the Grass lineup
complete
last year.
Miscarriage of musical justice.
Yeah. It was an affront to democracy. But yeah, we said that, you know, you guys should have had the lineup, should have been in the lineup for Splendor. And someone left a comment. One of our loyal readers said, and like I mentioned this to you before, they said, I was at a Mike Whitney gig. It was an RSL somewhere down the coast. He said, I was at the Mike Whitney gig, a Mike Whitney Band gig, and I requested for a bit of sherbet, and Mike Whitney told me to fuck off because this is a rock and roll band.
I might have said, go away. Yeah, but that's true. I think he requested Summer Love by Sherbet, and that's definitely not in our repertoire at all. Look, the band's a crazy story. I don't even think about it that much. When I was about 16, an older brother of one of my mates bought a bass. Maybe I was 15, Ray was 17. Within 6 months, another mate had bought drums. Another one of our mates had played guitar since he was a kid, so he was quite a good guitarist. And we've taken over Ray's parents' garage in Beecham Road in Matraville, opposite Matraville Public School, where we all went to school. We took over the garage and we had this band in there. We had the band in there probably on and off for a couple of years. I never played any musical instruments, so all of a sudden I'm singing. Mm. So we played Deep Purple, bit of Uriah Heep, just songs that were not that hard to play with a bass, a guitar, drums and a singer. And then when I got to like 18, the guitarist got a girl pregnant. He had to go. The drummer wanted to buy a V8 Ford, so we sold the drum kit.
Like a good band.
And Ray kept playing, and I went off and did the cricket thing.
Yeah.
Run into Ray a lot. He moved out to Ryde. As it happens, about 15 years ago at Channel 7, this guy says, I'm in this band, and have a look at the DVD. So there's Ray And he knew I would recognise him. And I hadn't seen Ray for about 10 years at that stage. So we hook up again, and Ray says, why don't we have a rehearsal? Like a just a, you know, a get-together, just a jam. And I went, Ray, and I was like 17. You know, it's like 40 years ago. 30 years ago at the time. And he goes, we'll just get together and have a jam. So we did, and we played about 25 songs and probably 15 I knew because my sister and I have always sang. Mm-hmm. So I sing in the shower and the car a lot. I love it. Mm-hmm. Grew up with the Beatles, man. Come on, you know?
Yeah.
So we had another jam, and then about 3 weeks later he says, we've got rehearsal. I go, rehearsal for fucking what? The band. I went, no, man. I haven't got time to yeah. you know, you, because if I'm going to hook into something, it's not a half pie gig for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in. And I knew that if I took this on, I'm no muso. It's all right singing the songs on the radio. They want me to be the front man.
Yeah.
So they worked on me. And I relented because the band started to sound good in rehearsal.
Yeah.
And then they said, these are the 70 songs that we want you to learn, because we're only a covers band. Probably 30 of them I knew, but looking at the words of those 30, a lot of the words that I'd been singing weren't the words that yeah. were in the song. So I started it. When we actually hit the stage, you'd get to that spot in the song and go, oh, is it summer or bummer, you know, and swallow it. Come on. Well, now the band's been gigging 13 years. We probably play about 15 or 20 gigs a year. That's not a lot, but I'm busy and other guys in the band are busy. But it's the most fun I've had since playing cricket. I don't know whether it'll go any further than what we do, just playing around pubs and pub gigs. But I'm comfortable with it now. It took me 10 years to get comfortable being the front man, and I'm really comfortable now. I mean, I'd be in the middle of a song and someone would walk right up to the front of the stage and yell out, who dares wins? And I'm in the middle of The Boys Are Back in Town by Thin Lizzy. And I'd go, what the fuck was that? But it was 11:30, a lot of alcohol in the room. Yeah. Midnight, the out of it dust just comes down from the ceiling and everybody just goes berserk. So I had to deal with that too. And that was a bit tough for me because I don't drink.
Have you ever sung the Who Dares Wins theme on stage?
No, I haven't. But I don't drink alcohol anymore. So when I'm in pubs that are...
You notice them are a lot more... They're a lot more obnoxious.
Man, I was one of those. Don't worry. So, yeah, but look, it's been great and just another thing to sort of have a box and, you know, lock that in. And there's been a fair few boxes and I'm really grateful.
All right.
Well, I think we've just wrapped up. Have you got any more in the near future?
Yeah, we play at the Bayview Tavern at Gladesville quite often. I think we got a couple of gigs there at the end of the year. Bondi RSL in a couple of weeks, which is a local gig. We play South Juniors at the Junction, places like that. We used to play the Marlborough Hotel in Newtown. We played there for about 5 years. That's a good gig. They used to line up out the door to see the Mike Whitney band there. So I
Queensland? You going to take it to Queensland?
Look, the boys have talked about going away, but I've spent 40 years on the road. You know, I just can't see myself doing that shit, which you should have been doing when you were 20.
Packing
the van up.
The Caribbean again. For
well, I think that the Mike Whitney band would play some reggae over there, you know.
With Vivian.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, Mike, mate. Yeah, mate, it's been great to talk to you.
Look, and you dudes are really famous, and I think my media career has reached the full circle.
Well, mate,
being on the podcast with you,
I don't know. Channel 7's got the
cricket. And the Batuta Advocate, mate. When we made the band, made the Batuta, mate, that was it. We made it.
Well, Channel 7's got the cricket, mate, so I don't think your career's gone full circle. I think there might be a few taps on the shoulder this year.
I hope so. I've actually sent a couple of emails to some important people saying I'd really love to do the cricket. I've been at the network 24 years and finally the cricket's at the network.
Yeah.
And if I only want to work another couple of years, what a beautiful thing that'd be to do Weekender and the cricket to finish me career off at Channel 7.
You listening to this, Stokesy?
Mister. Now, Kerry and I are on first name terms. You're a pretty good bloke, Kerry Stokes, actually. I like Kerry.
Yeah.
Beauty. Well, hope to see you commentating the cricket this year. And in the near future, and thanks for joining us.
Good on you, boys. My absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you. And that was Mike Whitney, boys and girls, TV star, cricketing hero, and in God's perfect world, he'll be hosting the cricket this summer on Channel 7.
Yeah, it's a bit of differentiation between the commentators and, you know, a bit of character. Mike Whitney definitely has that. Thank you for joining us, Michael.
And until next week, my name is Errol Parker. You be good to yourselves, keep your hands to yourselves, and stay out of the pokies.
Yes, I'm Clancy Overall. Be kind to each other.
Right now at Honda, find your kind of value. With a low finance rate offer on selected Civic hatch and sedan models, there's never been a better time to get into a Civic. So talk to your local dealer and let's help you into a Honda today. T's and C's apply. Ends August 31st. See website for details.